Welcome to The Roundup, a North Queensland-based podcast with regional content for regional clinicians. I'm Alyssa Hathaway, a GP and family planning clinician and head of JCU's clinical school here in Mackay. This collaborative podcasting project between North Queensland Regional Training Hubs, JCU, and our local regional hospital and health services will bring you a different regionally relevant podcast each fortnight. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands where we meet today, who were the original providers of healthcare in this region. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Laura Smith, a psychiatrist in the Cairns region who works in the public system with North Queensland's Eating Disorder Service. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Alyssa. Thanks for having me.
This is a really important topic to talk about, isn't it? Binge eating disorders. Why have you become interested in this field?
Eating disorders generally are pretty big, broad topic. And, you know, I'm, I guess, reasonably new to working in the eating disorder space. I've been essentially working with people with eating disorders specifically for the last couple of years. And I think a lot of us have that sort of stereotypical idea of what an eating disorder is. And sometimes it leads us to kind of miss picking up on people with eating disorders who don't kind of fit with that stereotypical image that we have. But I think it's, you know, it's a really important, particularly, you know, eating disorders for people in bigger bodies is a really important topic. And it's something we're sort of learning more and more about.
Yeah, you're right. So can you talk to us a little bit more about these eating disorders in bigger bodies and what we should be on the lookout for in our day-to-day practice?
Sure. Yeah. So I think just stepping back and thinking about eating disorders generally, we know that they're serious, complex, and life-threatening mental illnesses. And as a group, they're characterized by disturbances in behaviors, thoughts, and attitudes to food, eating, and body weight and shape. But that can present very differently, which is why we have a number of different diagnoses that are described in our Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, also known as our DSM-5. For the most part, those illnesses all share main maintaining processes, which are over-evaluation of weight, shape, and eating and their control, perfectionism, low core self-esteem, mood intolerance, and interpersonal difficulties. And these can present with sort of different behaviors. And as a result, we can see that an individual can present with a different diagnosis over the course of their life, but also how our treatment approaches can be used more broadly across diagnoses. And I guess that sort of forms what we call the transdiagnostic theory, which was coined by British psychiatrist Christopher Fairbairn. I guess when we think about eating disorders in bigger bodies, as I mentioned, you know, I think there is some growing awareness, but it's still a group that experiences different challenges related to weight stigma within our culture and our health system.
Yeah, right. So when we're thinking about eating disorders more broadly, what's the prevalence and the impact on our community and our country as a whole, Laura?
Well, I guess Deloitte released their second edition of Paying the Price, which was commissioned by the Butterfly Foundation and essentially was geared at estimating the social and economic costs of eating disorders in Australia. They released their second edition last year and they noticed that there's a 21% increase in Australians living with an eating disorder in 2023 compared with 2012 when they released the first edition. So that's equivalent to 1 in 23 people. And they also estimated that there were 1,273 deaths last year as a result of an eating disorder. So I think we can see, you know, that there's significant personal and community costs with regards to physical and mental health consequences.
Oh, most definitely. Those numbers are terrifying, aren't they? Now, of course, when we think about eating disorders, most people in the community, the medical community or the broader community, would think about anorexia nervosa, wouldn't they?
Yes, I think so. Certainly, I think there's sort of variable levels of kind of education and awareness of binge eating disorder. And it's interesting, we, you know, with the North Queensland Eating Disorder Service, we've actually noticed that there are a number of patients who are presenting to their GPs or even just being identified by their GPs as potentially having binge eating disorder and they're being referred to us. So it's good to see, I think, that there is some increasing awareness out there. We know that binge eating disorder is actually the most common eating disorder and that 47% of people with an eating disorder will have binge eating disorder.
47% of people with binge eating disorder. Goodness me.
That's right, yeah. And I think, you know, they sort of say that the average age of onset is around 25. Our experience is that we have the people being referred to us are sort of in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and they're only just sort of being identified, but they're sort of having suffered with the illness in secret for many years.
Right. So many years of symptoms potentially. What sort of things will people be presenting with? What are their histories like, Laura?
So I suppose when we talk about binge eating disorder and what it means, people experience binge eating episodes. So that's where they consume more than what we would consider normal in a 2-hour period. They feel like they have a sense of loss of control while they're eating. They can be eating more rapidly than normal or eating when they're not hungry. It often occurs in secret and to the point where they feel really sick or uncomfortably full. And that's followed by feelings of guilt, disgust, and depression. But unlike in bulimia nervosa, there's no compensation through purging behaviors. And we do have some theories to describe why that the illness develops and how it's then maintained. And certainly evidence supports the role of binge eating in a way of regulating negative affects, so as a coping strategy. And we also know that biologically we can see that there are alterations in reward processing and inhibitory control in binge eating disorder, which is similar to what we see in substance use disorders.
Oh, wow. So can you tell us a little bit about the patients who you see? What are the common themes? And you mentioned some of those, that they'd be feeling the guilt, the disgust, and the depression.
Yeah. So my experience with these patients is that there is so much shame. And often the patients also have limited awareness about opportunities for treatment. They also, it has a huge negative impact on their physical and mental health, certainly contributes to metabolic syndrome, and certainly lots of comorbid anxiety and depressive disorders. And I think it's also important for us to think as well about that experience of the journey through the Western healthcare system for someone in a bigger body. And I think in health, we do have a largely unchallenged perspective of obesity as an avoidable health risk factor that gets in the way of us being able to treat and prevent disease. You know, historically, obesity has been medicalized, and as doctors, we have recommended that people go on diets. But really, there's poor evidence to support the effectiveness of any diet. And, you know, you can't pick the right diet if none of them will work. It's sort of an inconvenient truth that weight loss from voluntary restricting your calories isn't sustainable in 90% of cases. And that's as a result of our energy homeostasis, which means when our body fat mass deviates from its natural level, we experience an increase in the drive to eat and a decreased rate of energy expenditure, which then persists until the lost weight is regained. And they actually, in 2016, they did a study on some contestants that were in the first season of The Biggest Loser. And this study was reported in the Journal of Obesity. So it followed 14 contestants during and after one season of the show. And the contestants lost an average of over 45 kilos each. But by the final weigh-in, their leptin levels had plummeted and they were constantly hungry and their metabolism had slowed, partly as a result their altered thyroid function. And then over the following 6 years, the combined effects of those hormonal changes resulted in the contestants regaining most, if not all, of the weight. And they also found that the leptin and metabolism levels never rebounded to their prior baseline. And the more weight that they lost, the worse the slow metabolism became.
Holy cow. And that's certainly not helped by the stigma around weight. As you mentioned, you know, patients might see doctors who are dismissive of their bigger bodies or judgmental of their bigger shape. We need to acknowledge the struggle that these patients live with on a day-to-day basis, don't we?
Yeah, that's right, Alyssa. And, you know, our studies do show that, you know, even unbeknownst to us, we might hold some damaging attitudes and stereotypes, which can influence the way that we interact and care for our patients. And that has a flow-on effect for our patients. They can become more avoidant of care, mistrustful of doctors, less likely to adhere to treatment regimes. And they've actually shown as well that there can be an increase in binge eating behavior and a lower motivation to exercise, which is the opposite of what we want. And some experimental studies have also demonstrated increased calorie consumption after exposure to weight stigmatization. So we can see that this, you know, so-called war on obesity could be adding to the explosion of eating disorders with actually having very little impact on reducing obesity rates. And we know that dieting is a huge risk factor for developing an eating disorder. So it's really important for us as healthcare practitioners to be mindful of what works and what doesn't, and that we aren't causing harm.
Now, Laura, one term that I've heard mentioned is atypical anorexia nervosa. Does that sometimes fit with people with the bigger bodies with eating disorders?
Yeah, that's correct. So atypical anorexia nervosa is another kind of more recently described eating disorder, and it is people in bigger bodies usually. So essentially it's the same, defined by the same criteria as someone with anorexia nervosa, but the person loses a considerable amount of weight while remaining within what we would consider a normal BMI range. And that comes at the moment under the category of other specified feeding or eating disorder in our DSM. But studies show that these patients have serious psychological distress and are at similar risk of malnutrition and starvation as in, you know, the general form of anorexia nervosa. So it really kind of raises questions about the utility of using body mass index in this setting, and whether it might be more helpful for us to consider sort of a natural set point weight, which we see as being a healthy weight individually determined by a mix of various factors, including genetics. And sometimes we can try and get an idea about an adult's set point weight by thinking about their family of origin, body types, ethnic background, a personal weight history, whether they might have had symptoms and signs of starvation at different weights, and sort of what weight they were at when they felt most physically well. And I think, you know, it's just this patient group as well is definitely under-recognized. And even within anorexia nervosa, there's often this sense that people aren't sick enough to warrant care. So it's even more pronounced in this group, in the bigger body, where they may not be recognized by their healthcare providers as being sick enough. And that sort of feeds further into that idea. And we know as well that this is another group of patients where health-related counseling can be an illness precipitating factor.
Okay, Laura, so we've already covered so much information today. We've talked about eating disorders being really complex and sometimes serious and life-threatening mental illnesses, where 1 in 23 Australians might be impacted, 47% of those Australians with binge eating disorders. And as you mentioned, you know, often we've been focusing eating disorder care on people with lower weights who might be exhibiting those symptoms and signs of starvation, but might be missing that really bigger, that much bigger cohort of people at the average onset of 25. Now, with our work in primary care, as you mentioned, sometimes we can actually precipitate an eating disorder unintentionally by trying to improve someone's general health. How should we be approaching these people in our day-to-day practice?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it's really important that we are mindful of our own biases and sort of question how it could be impacting our work, and consider adopting something like a health at every size framework. So that's a public health framework that was developed in the 1960s and suggests that people should be seeking to adopt healthy behaviours regardless of their body weight. So it's more of a weight neutral as opposed to a weight loss stance. And it focuses on weight inclusivity, just enhancing health, eating for well-being, respectful care, and life-enhancing movement. I think the other thing, of course, that's important as well is that we have eating disorders on our radar, and particularly eating disorders for people in bigger bodies, and that, you know, there are some simple screening tools that can be used to kind of identify whether someone might be at risk or might be suffering from an eating disorder and would benefit from kind of further assessment and care with a specialized service.
Fantastic. We love a screening tool. Can you talk us through those tools that you find most useful in your practice?
So for our general mental health services, we tend to recommend what we call the SCOF, which is a 5-item questionnaire. And the 5 questions are, do you make yourself sick because you feel uncomfortably full? Do you worry you have lost control over how much you eat? Have you recently lost more than 1 stone or 6.35 kilos in a 3-month period? Do you believe yourself to be fat when others say you are too thin? Would you say food dominates your life? So that's a good sort of general screening tool for most of the eating disorders. And if someone says yes to one of those questions, it should suggest that perhaps there's further assessment done. The one that's kind of more specific for a binge eating disorder is the BED7, which is a 7-item screening tool, which is also quite simple and quick to use and easily available online.
Fantastic. So if we have a patient presenting to us in whom we're concerned about binge eating disorder, and we use our screening tools and our alerts are even higher, where do we best direct our patients for evidence-based treatment, Laura?
That's a great question. So in Cairns, we ask our GPs to refer to our service where we conduct a further assessment and then make recommendations about treatment, whether that involves treatment in our service or whether that involves treatment in the private sector, which is also sometimes appropriate. And really, for, I guess, in terms of binge eating disorder, the treatment depends predominantly upon patients' goals. So if they're wanting to reduce episodes of binge eating, body image concern, and psychiatric comorbidity, there's good evidence for psychotherapy and that sort of interpersonal therapy or cognitive behavior therapy enhanced, which is a specialized form of CBT for eating disorders and has good evidence in controlled studies for therapy that's delivered over 10 or 20 sessions, as well as therapist guided and unguided self-help and internet delivery. We recently ran a group with our service that was group-based guided self-help for binge eating disorder. It was a small group, but we did have favorable results and we're looking to retrial that. And I guess in terms of pharmacotherapy, so sometimes psychotherapy might be not available where the patient is living or not appropriate for some reason, or pharmacotherapy can be used as an adjunct. And so we know that SSRIs are shown to be effective, and particularly fluoxetine at higher doses has good evidence at reducing binge eating episodes in bulimic patients. So we would imagine that it would sort of have a similar effect in people with binge eating disorder. Lisdexamfetamine has also been approved by the TGA for treatment in binge eating disorder, and there's some evidence for topiramate as well, although sometimes patients don't tolerate that medication particularly well.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Because the SSRIs might often worsen a patient's appetite. And of course, lisdexamfetamine will reduce someone's appetite. So that seems appropriate.
Yeah. And I think really the binge eating isn't so much related to appetite. It's more, you know, we're going back to that. It's sort of a coping strategy for when people are feeling overwhelmed. So I think it's really around settling down that mood instability in terms of how it's working, the SSRIs.
Sure. So then if that patient still wants assistance in terms of weight loss, could we in primary practice then direct those patients to other weight loss medications without too dreadfully impacting the binge eating disorder?
Yeah. So certainly if weight loss is a goal, then, you know, the options are things like medications that you guys can prescribe in primary care or bariatric surgery even. And sometimes that is also guided by the patient goals, but also by their medical comorbidities, which need to be addressed. We know that like those sorts of interventions don't actually address the eating disorder psychopathology. So they're not going to address those core maintaining processes. So they may, you know, while a patient is taking a medication, it may reduce the binge eating episodes or stop the binge eating episodes. But then once the medication is withdrawn, they would likely return if the patient hasn't engaged in psychotherapy.
It's such a complicated system, isn't it, Laura?
It is. It is, yeah.
So I imagine then the multidisciplinary team in managing these binge eating disorder patients is more vital than ever.
Yes, across eating disorders generally, we really support that multidisciplinary team care. You know, the patient supported by the GP, psychiatrist, dietitian, psychologist, peer support, and then, of course, their own family support and network. And we know as well that, you know, across an eating disorder generally, that people can require access to a range of different services at different levels of intensity or frequency across the course of their illness and recovery. And we want treatment to be patient-centered and informed by principles and guidelines, lived experience and research and evaluation. The National Eating Disorder Collaboration released their National Eating Disorders Strategy last year, which is a 10-year plan. And essentially, you know, their goal is to have coordinated evidence-based services matched to a person's needs with the ability to step up or down the intensity in response to a person's changing needs, whether that's psychological, physical, nutritional, and psychosocial. And I think also, you know, across mental health generally, there's increasing awareness about the benefits of incorporating lived experience, whether that's in peer work, lived experience clinicians, or patient advocacy or advisory roles.
And I've no doubt that that National Eating Disorders Strategy recognises the disparate services available across this country.
That's correct. And hopefully, you know, that there will be kind of more funding delivered to those areas to support development of services.
So, Laura, for those of us in general practice, what's our main role in managing these patients once we've identified them and used our BED7 or SCOF screening tool to help identify these patients and got them involved with a multidisciplinary team in our local area?
Yeah, so I guess we're thinking about just general sort of treatment of eating disorders. We sort of break it down to the steps of establishing a therapeutic alliance, the monitoring and stabilizing of the medical state, reversing any cognitive or behavioral effects of starvation, and then, you know, the flow on to psychotherapy where the patient can learn to more adaptively deal with their emotions, resist cultural pressures, and to identify and challenge eating disorder thoughts. So the GP role is really crucial in that medical monitoring and supporting the medical stability. And sometimes, you know, if a patient is particularly unwell, in the case of sort of lower weight eating disorders, significant starvation or sort of frequent purging behaviours, that medical monitoring may even be weekly, and also supporting things like bone health and ensuring like coordination of that multidisciplinary treatment. So referrals to dietitian, psychology and psychiatry, which can be supported with the Medicare eating disorder treatment and management plan. And I think the GP also plays a huge role in supporting and educating the patient and family as well.
That eating disorders treatment plan, that can include up to 20 visits with a psychologist over a year, can't it, Laura?
It can actually be up to 40 sessions with a psychologist. So if the patient is reviewed either by a pediatrician or a psychiatrist sort of just before or after the 20th session, the pediatrician or psychiatrist can suggest whether it would be appropriate for the patient to have an additional 20 sessions within the year. And if that is appropriate, then that patient can access those additional 20 sessions. And they can also, you know, just with the initial GP referral, they can also have the 20 sessions with a dietitian as well, which is very important.
That's a fantastically supportive framework in which to work, isn't it? Now, Laura, can you just talk to us a little bit about what that psychotherapy looks like? Because for those of us who are not psychologists, it's sometimes a bit of a black box, isn't it? We send someone off to a psychologist and we're not 100% sure what happens in those sessions.
Yeah, so I think it is good to know a little bit, obviously, about it because you guys are working hand in hand with the therapists along the way. So the main evidence-based treatment across most eating disorders, as I mentioned, is CBTE, and that's primarily what we deliver at our service. And as I mentioned, it is enhanced for eating disorders, and we can use it to treat people with anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and eating disorder not otherwise specified. And that's because it focuses on those core maintaining processes and essentially uses strategic changes in behavior to modify thinking. So the psychologist will do lots of behavioral experiments with the patient. It's broken down into a few stages. So there's an evaluation where the patient is prepared for treatment and change. Stage one, then where the therapist engages the patient in producing a joint formulation and establishing what we call self-monitoring, where the patient is asked to record their eating behavior, their thoughts, their emotions in real time, which they then bring back to sessions. Collaborative weekly weighing, education, establishing regular eating and involving loved ones. And then in stage two, the therapist and the patient together take stock, review their progress, revise the formulation if required. And then stage three is sort of tailored to the individual patient, and it focuses on the over-evaluation of shape and weight, addressing some body checking behaviors which might be perpetuating the illness, the idea of feeling fat, which is common to eating disorders, dietary rules, event-related changes in eating, clinical perfectionism, low self-esteem and interpersonal problems. And then stage four is about ending well and focusing on maintaining the progress and reducing risk of lapse. And in general, people who are kind of normal or above normal weight will complete that within 20 sessions, but people who are underweight will require the 40 sessions.
Okay, that's really interesting, Laura. So then the dietitian, when they can be part of those sessions as well, what will their intervention look like?
Yeah, the dietitian is a really important component in helping the patient with establishing regular eating. So the literature is still being developed to support the evidence base and the specific intervention and how that kind of works in with therapy. But we know that, you know, it's important for the patient to be supported by the dietitian alongside the therapist. Essentially, in our clinic, we run a brief 5-session intervention called Renourish Clinic. And that's based on existing work done by dietitian Caitlin McMaster and also supported by Queensland's own Shane Jeffries RAVES model. And the RAVES model is kind of a way of getting a person to normalize their eating behavior through a stepwise approach. So basically, the first step is sort of regularity. So we're trying to get the patient to eat every 3 to 4 hours. And then the second step is adequacy. So we're wanting that each meal and snack to be adequate in terms of portion. Then the next step is variety, so that each meal or snack has a good variety of macro and micronutrients. And then the last two, which are a little bit more difficult, are eating socially and eating spontaneously. And so in our Renourish clinic, our goals are really to improve nutritional intake, help reduce or cease eating disorder behaviors, help the patient gain or maintain weight, address their medical and nutritional consequences through psychoeducation and developing skills, and improve their ability to manage their nutritional needs independently. And then also to address some of the social and practical aspects of food and eating that will help improve the patient's quality of life.
Okay, so we need the patients eating regularly, adequately, eating a variety, then eating socially and even eating spontaneously. It's interesting just thinking about what it is that we do when we're feeding ourselves, when we break it down in such detail.
It is, isn't it? It's something that a lot of us do so naturally, but for people with eating disorders, it's so much more complicated.
Such a struggle. Now, Laura, I think we've covered an enormous amount of information today. We've talked about eating disorders being common, serious mental illnesses associated with significant morbidity and mortality. We've talked about patients with eating disorders coming in all shapes and sizes, and that as healthcare providers, we need to be mindful of potentially causing harm when we're trying to care for our patients with bigger bodies. We've talked about treatments for eating disorders with a stepped model of care and a multidisciplinary approach, including psychotherapy, medications, and the vital role of the dietitian. We've talked about interventions that can help people recover and improve their quality of life. This has been an enormously important topic to discuss today, Laura. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Alyssa.
For more information about the Roundup, or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline, and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.